Welcome to this podcast extra from KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, curiosity leads many of us to study up on a subject of interest. Often enough, when author Timothy Egan gets curious, there's a book in the making. Here, Egan reads a passage from his latest, The Immortal Irishman, an exploration of the tragically glorious life of Thomas Francis Marr. You can hear Egan's full talk, and it's worth a listen, on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Timothy Egan is a Seattle native, a New York Times columnist, and the author of 7 books. He received the National Book Award for his work on the Great Depression, The Worst Hard Time. Timothy Egan spoke at Town Hall Seattle on March 1st. Thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording.
And he comes to New York City, and now we see part 3 of the Thomas Marr adventure. And I'm going to read a short passage here of what New York City was like when Thomas Marr arrived in 1852. He, as I said, had pulled off this spectacular escape, and news of it had spread. They knew he was coming, and all the Irish American newspapers were beating the bush, were proclaiming this savior who would soon arrive on American shores. He had seen half the world from a ship's deck, and yet nothing prepared him for how many of the earth's uprooted strivers had stuffed themselves into New York City of 1852. Carriages dashed and shifted, horses clopped and whinnies, stevedores grunted and cursed, all in waves, not the music of commerce, but the off-key chorus of chaos. Boatmen, ferrymen, porters, carters, stage drivers, washerwomen, predators of immigrants, domestics walking other people's children, and teenage girls in face paint handing out flyers for the afternoon melodrama in the Bowery. Was that the Teutonic tongue coming from Kleindeutschland, the third largest German-speaking community in the world? And was that Yiddish rising from the cluster of rag merchants a few blocks in another direction? And what hybrid of the Queen's English was this dialect of free blacks working dockside? Surely a hint of County Kildare clattered from that basement street cleaning crew, and his own Munster brogue rolled out of a basement shebeen. All of this in the kinetic claustrophobia of the Lower East Side, nursery of a nation whose people were looking less like the mother country by the day. Around one turn, the smells were unpleasant in the late spring humidity. There was sweat twined with horse shit and dog shit and pig shit, the piles to be swept into the river by day's end, 6,000 cartloads a night. A few blocks away, he was hit with a waft of fresh-cooked offerings of barefoot girls who enticed customers with this chant, "Hot corn, here's your nice hot corn, smoking hot, just from the pot." The island of Manhattan was smaller than the prison district where Thomas Marr had been condemned to spend the rest of his life, but it held a world of fellow exiles from Russia's pogrom-swept villages, from the Rhine's ruined farms, from Africa's plundered hamlets, and of course, from the ashen-blighted fields abandoned by those strong enough to walk away from the great hunger of Ireland. On May 27th, the day Marr stepped ashore, this New York City was home to 20,000 Jews, 12,000 African-Americans, 60,000 Germans, and 160,000 Irish. It was the densest concentration of Irish anywhere on earth. More than 1 in 4 New Yorkers in a city of nearly 600,000 had been born in Marr's homeland. He walked now by City Hall, where men not long from Limerick or Kilkenny held actual power. He walked up Broadway, past the booksellers and portrait studios. He walked onward toward Canal Street, then right in the direction of the Bowery. On alternate days, bare-knuckle boxing shared space with Shakespeare plays, and a scattering of Irish soon became a thicket of Irish. These people looked worn down and dirty-faced. Their tenements were awful, awful, wooden jails that would combust in a poof from an untended cigar. Here, flop joints, groggeries, and a row of slouch-roofed boarding houses anchored a city block. Nearby, a former brewery converted from making beer to warehousing immigrants. It was a home to 1,000 people living in stairwells and doorways. For 37 cents a week, you could sleep in a windowless room on a floor with straw. For 18 cents a week, just the bare floor with a bucket for your latrine. Then he walked south to the center of this stew of startover people, the neighborhood of Five Points. He knew this place, five blocks in the heart of the Sixth Ward, by reputation, for Charles Dickens had come through Five Points a few years earlier, notebook in hand, two cops by his side. The novelist was stunned to see the mix of races, Irish and blacks, drinking together, dancing in the saloons, a born in America toe and heel tap dance that was a blend of Gaelic jig and West African step. That was the birth of tap dancing. In darkened corners, mixed race couples kissed and groped. Where Anthony, Orange, and Cross Streets came together, Dickens saw a place, quote, loathsome, drooping, and decayed. No part of London could match the wretchedness of the neighborhood. It was without grass or trees. It was without a sliver of green. And thereafter, tourists paid armed men to guide them through an evening of slumming among the poor Irish for a chance to be appalled at, quote, shanties in which the pigs and the Patricks lie down together, as the New York Times informed a readership accustomed to bedding in clean linen. Organized crime, an oxymoron in Five Points, was often overshadowed by those babbling to themselves in the neighborhood's midst, for the change in worlds had broken minds as well as souls. Two-thirds of the inmates of the New York City Lunatic Asylum, a gray granite fortress on Blackwell Island in East River, were Irish. As well, Aaron's cast-offs were at the top of all the social pathologies in the city, but one, all but one, that being suicide. The Irish killed themselves with liquor, with accidents prompted by drink, with neglect, with disease, with violence, but would never end their own lives by their own hands, for that would ensure that misery would follow them to eternity. For these cobblestone streets of squalor, had families really traded clan gatherings in emerald valleys? For the piss and brew stench of a tenement, had they swapped sea-scrubbed air? Did 1 million people flee genocidal starvation for a slum with the highest death rate in the new nation? Here was, quote, the scattered debris of the Irish nation. Little wonder that the newspapers drew cartoons of them as apes, filthy apes lacking only a tail. Never before had so many Irish come ashore as the year leading up to Mars' first day in America's biggest city. They were rural peasants, mostly. They were people without skills or trade. Most were illiterate. They were swept across an ocean by catastrophe, the first big wave of the largest transfer of people the world had yet experienced in so short a time. They had left more than 20,000 villages to press into one large village in Lower Manhattan. Now, the Irish did not know it yet on this last Thursday in May that one of the most prominent of their political refugees now, as of this day, walked among them, an escapee from Tasmania by way of South America. But he was expected. The Boston Pilot had reported in its May 15th edition that Marr was free. After exchanging ships in Brazil, he was due to arrive in the city any day. And the paper put the stamp of destiny on Thomas Marr before he even saw New York Harbor. In him, they said, the Irish will find a chief to unite and guide them.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum. Again, you can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Timothy Egan spoke at Town Hall Seattle on March 1st. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in again soon.